Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Once upon a time, there was a man by the name of Buzal. He was an enlightened man. Not only was he an enlightened man, his wife was enlightened also. And not only was his wife enlightened, his son was enlightened also. And not only was his son enlightened, but his daughter was enlightened also. Pretty good, huh? And one day a man came to him, to this Buzal, and he said, is Zen difficult or not? And this Buzal said to him, oh, it is very difficult. It is like taking a stick and trying to hit the moon. Very difficult. And this man was very puzzled by this. I mean, take a stick and hit the moon, you know. And he began to think, well, you know, this is not the only person that has achieved enlightenment. There are others. And we have a whole history of people that have attained enlightenment. And not only that, his wife, you know. So he went to her, and he asked the same question. Is Zen difficult? And she says, it's the easiest thing in the world, you know. It's like touching your nose when you wash your face. And this confused this man, poor little soul. And he says, I don't understand this. Is Zen easy? Is it difficult? Who's right? So he went to the son, and he asked him. And the son said, it is not difficult, and it is not easy. On the tips of 100 blades of grass is the Buddha's meaning. Have you seen in the morning on the tips of the blades of grass? There it is, huh? All written out for you. But this man, you know, not difficult, not easy. What is it then, you know? So he went to the daughter and he asked her, you know, he said, your father and your mother and your brother have all given me different answers. You know, who's right? What is Zen? Is it difficult? Is it easy? And she says, if you make it difficult, it is difficult. If you make it easy, it is easy. But if you don't think, the truth is just as it is. That's something to think about, huh? Yeah. You know, in religions, in traditions, Orthodox traditions, you know, most of them have what they call a first principle. It's a sort of like a comprehensive and fundamental law or a doctrine or an assumption as to what was first. And, you know, that everything else follows this first. See, what is a first principle? See, it's like a primary source, which is the origin. And in Christianity, we have to the effect that God is the first cause, and through his word, all else follows. Hmm? Now, Zen says that the first principle cannot be verbalized. However, you know, and I think we would all agree, but they, like all other traditions, do try to define something about it so that we're not just hanging out there. So they say this world, which they call samsara, this world of appearance, the world of appearances, the phenomenal world, as Kant called it, huh? This world, samsara, is nirvana, which we might say heaven, huh? Nirvana. Nirvana means blown out. When the appearances are blown out and the ego is blown out, what is there? That's nirvana. So samsara is nirvana, nirvana is samsara. The phenomenal and the noumenal world are one. The ordinary is the extraordinary. If you see it without the ego, then the ordinary is the extraordinary. This world is the other world. That the profane is sacred, is the sacred. So it's one world, not two. One world. One world with two aspects. One world. It's not two. But with our cultural background here in this Western world, it's a little difficult for us to understand sometimes. And in our usual pursuit of religions, we depend upon distinctions. You know, that's good and this is bad. We have this distinction. This I must accomplish and that I must avoid. And because I want to accomplish this, and I see certain things about it, and I read certain things about it, so I begin to live in a certain manner, to act out that part. I eat some things, and I don't eat other things, and so that there develops a particular style in which you live. You do certain things, and because in your head they're good, and this is the way it should be achieved, because you're doing this, you know, you begin to feel a little bit holier than thou from others who are not doing what you are doing. And there are monks in certain religious orders that think they're very holy because they're doing certain rituals and they're avoiding the world. And so in this frame of reference, in this frame of mind, holiness depends upon and consists of doing. See, your behavior, your doing. I'm doing this and it is good. I'm avoiding that because it's bad. Therefore, my holiness depends upon what I am doing. In that frame. Zen turns this around. It insists that doing is not so important. What is important is being. The being. By doing, doing things, in, you know, as I described, is building a facade. It is layering like garments of clothing over the being. And by doing this, fundamentally, you don't change. if being changes, then your doing changes out of yourself, and not something that you have layered on, but it is from within out, not from without to the in. And it was Meister Eckhart that said, you know, you achieve through transformed knowledge. Transformed knowledge. And it is by reason of transformed knowledge that we are made perfect, he said. By what happens to us within, in our inner worlds, see, to the being, rather than by what we do. And when this transformation comes about, and there are many stages of it, but this transformed knowledge all of a sudden, it is coming from within, is like this new light. There's a new quality to the person, huh? And this is a happening within one. It is not a doing. Do I make myself clear? Okay. Now, Jainism, one of the six great philosophies out of India, they do not hold to a belief in God. Their faith, so their mainstay, everything revolves around their 24 teachers. They had 24 teachers, and they are called Tirthankaras, the conquerors. They conquered. And these were the founders, these 24. They are called liberated souls. And they were once in bondage with the ego and all the rest of it, and became free through their own efforts. And so each is called, each person who becomes enlightened, that is, becomes free through one's own efforts, is a jivatman. Jiva. Jiva means free. Jiva means soul or spirit. So it is a free soul, a free spirit. Jivatman. And now, the last of these great teachers was called Mahavira. He lived about the same time as the Buddha lived, so that's about 2,500 years before. 2,500 years ago, about the same time Lao Tzu, Buddha, and so Mahavira, this great Jain. The man, the teacher who preceded him, lived in the 9th century B.C. And the other 22, you know, prehistoric. But it is to these teachers that they look, and not to a god or to God. Now, these Jains are divided into two sects. One is white-robed. They wear white robes. And the other one doesn't wear anything. They're naked. Mahavira, the last great teacher, didn't wear any clothes, so those that follow him don't wear any clothes either. And the ones who followed the one before that, he wore white robes, so they wear white robes. So you know who's following who. But Mahavira became very careful about the kind of life he lived. He wouldn't even walk on the grass. He was afraid he would hurt it. and it would bruise it, because you could see the life in it. And they also wear masks over their faces, you know, so that they don't hurt anything that they might breathe in. You know, this is... Anyway, this Mahavira was very, very, very careful about the way he lived. And so his followers have been trying to do the same thing ever since. Huh? By doing. You know, it's a cultivated behavior. We have all cultivated a behavior of one kind or another because we live in society. We have cultivated a behavior, and then we have cultivated another behavior from whatever religion we belong to. But behavior does not change the being. The Upanishads, you know, put it very nicely, I think. It says, doing verily works in this world. One should wish to live 100 years in the... one should wish to live 100 years. Thus it is in thee, and not otherwise than this. And action cleaves not to a man. To live 100 years, doing as being. Action cleaves not to a man, to being. It is in thee. And of course, in that world, in that part of the world, and they still do, you know, they have India, from whence cometh the Upanishads. Sacrifice is a great part of their religion. I mean, they sacrifice in the morning a part of their food, and at noon, and at an evening meal. Always small. And during the day, flowers. They sacrifice, huh? Doing. This is a doing. It doesn't change being. The periphery does not change the center. Now, the Zenists say, this samsara, this wheel on which we go round, huh? This world is also the other world, huh? There really is no other world than this world. And this moment, as you breathe in, and you exhale, this moment is all. This moment now, this present. If you know this now, then you move to the next now, and to the next now, and to the next now. And it is all in now, this present. And if you're looking for another world, then you have a divided existence. An existence as such is indivisible. You can't divide it. You know, it is not the case of that you work and you strive and you suffer, and finally you come to the boundary of your world, and now comes the boundary of God's world. God isn't your neighbor. He's sitting in there in you. So, God immanent. If you look with an undivided eye, you can perceive both aspects at the same time of the same world. Now, most of us, I think practically everybody here has heard about the third eye. There's a third eye. There's the story of Cyclops and everything that had the third eye. Third eye. If Physically, we have two eyes, and this is our duality, and two ears, and so on. We live in a duality state. But those who have looked within and have gone within and gone deeper and deeper and deeper within, they say that there is a moment when this third eye opens. And this third eye is one. It's single. There's no more division. There's no more duality. Now, physically, of course, there isn't any third eye in your body. No, it's a metaphor. When you do not look at existence with a divided mind or with a dividing mind, you look at existence with an undivided consciousness, just consciousness, then it's one. And it's no longer you and the world. It is this world, this universe. Uni, it's one. Universe. And Jesus, you know, said to his disciples, if your eye is single, if you become one eye, then you shall know my kingdom of God. If thine eye be single, thine whole house shall be filled with light. Being. Samsara is nirvana, and nirvana is samsara. There is no division between spiritual and non-spiritual. Everything you can do in a spiritual way. Spirituality is a very deep acceptance of what is. What is? And in the Sanskrit, it is called tathata, suchness, such as it is. Whatever is the case is the case. The chair is hard. Maybe you're bored. You don't want to listen. Your own conversation with yourself. Accept it. This is the way it is at this moment. See, look into this moment. Zen people, they drink tea and they call it a ceremony. So drinking tea can be spiritual. Well, drinking anything can be spiritual. Now, ordinarily, it seems absurd. You say, drinking tea is spiritual. How can that be religious? Well, if I'm chanting a sacred name over and over and over again, that's spiritual. If I'm praying, that's spiritual. Or if I'm fasting, that's spiritual to some people, huh? But drinking tea, what's spiritual about that? Have you ever had a cup of tea with an undivided mind? There is no longer the tea and the drinker, you know. There is just this totality in this utter silence, in this stillness. And in this stillness, you know, there is the existence of God. So whatever you do, you can dig in the garden, you can wash the dishes, you know, plunk through the papers. If the mind becomes passive, just quiet, you know, shut it up. One with itself, you know, then all of a sudden there is this awareness. And in this awareness, you're stripped of the ego and you're stripped of the duality. And that I, that awareness, that's single. You know, the mind, it's so wonderful. It's like a prism, you know. There's this, let us say, this ray of light enters a prism. And as soon as the light enters the prism, we have seven colors. This is automatic, isn't it? This is how then the light appears, through the prism. All the colors of the rainbow, seven. That which enters the mind is also, I mean through the senses, is also one. That which comes out of the mind, that's seven. All colors of the rainbow. Now, to know the first principle, to know unity, one must get back to the source where the light enters the prism. The colors are the doing. It is the ray of light that is the being. And we call this source orientation. Now, people seek. All over the world, people are seeking. They don't know what they're looking for, but they look in religions and they look in the sciences, but there's something in here that drives people to seek. Now, there are two ways to seek. There's two ways to look. There is goal-oriented and there is source-oriented. Goal-oriented appears as a way, and that goal is out there in front of me. And so help me, Hannah, it is forever out there in front of me. It is something I have projected out there. It is an appearance of one of the colors that are, you know, of this prism, huh? Now, if we can really, truly understand that appearance as appearance, then the journey's half over. If you really, truly understand it. We are all prone to this trap of appearances. This is what the ego knows. This is what the mind, the thinking mind, knows. A goal-oriented seeker thinks in this manner, you know, sort of like, what do you suppose is the ultimate end of existence? He questions this, huh? To what meaning, is existence moving? Where are we going? What lessons am I learning? What are we going to become? What must I become? So he doesn't, he's goal-oriented, so he doesn't look to being, he looks to becoming. And we are always becoming. We become something every day. We get up in the morning and we become whatever we are. Being becomes. What am I to become? A saint? What is my destiny in the future? What is the goal that my life is striving to attain? The future. Well, the future doesn't exist. So the future can't answer you. You can imagine whatever you like. You can dream on and on and on. That future is never, ever going to turn back and look at you and say, hey, wait a minute now. Let's stop all this garbage. It can't do that. You have just projected something out there, huh? It never struggles with this reality. It never struggles with what is going on right here, right now. There isn't any reality in the future. You can go on imagining whatever you want. And we do, you know, we have these marvelous fantasies. I'm the Queen of Sheba, and who knows what else, huh? Who's to say I'm wrong? Nobody. That's my own doing, isn't it? Yeah. We are always right in the future. But in this moment, we come face to face with this moment. This reality destroys that imagining, that dream. You can look around and you can see that what you're imagining is not so. You've got to come to grips now with yourself. A goal-oriented person begins to think, how should I act so that my goal can be attained? And he begins to change his behavior, and he begins to change his style. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't change, when we change all the time, even though we don't know it. We should see our shortcomings, and we should do something about them. We should try a little harder to get together with ourselves. And we should try a little harder to hold a focus here. There's nothing wrong with that. We should be doing these. But that's not a religious goal, is it? That's just living with yourself every day. If you're a singer, you take voice lessons. If you're an artist, you take painting or drawing lessons. If you're a sempstress, you take sewing lessons. If you're a linguist, you take language lessons. But you can, in this manner, study all the religions in the world. Do you think it will give you transformation? Will it give you the single eye? So Zen says you strive and you work for being. And Zen has no rules as to how you should be. No, you got to be this and be that and be the other thing. No. It just says, don't set up a goal and imitate. Be yourself. Know your limitations and enjoy the possible. If you're trying too hard for the impossible, you're going to miss the possible. And you've missed everything. You know, humble people enjoy the possible. They don't ask for great things. They enjoy what's here. You know, small things. Playing with your own child. Eating your food. Eating your food is a pleasure. Going to bed at night and going to sleep is a pleasure. It's enjoyable. Going for a morning walk. Running on the beach. What do you want to be happy? Well, I mean, really, what do you want to be happy? On the beach, there's a touch of the cool sand. And there's a warm sun. And there's the sound of the sea. There's a laughter of a child. That's existence. Enjoy the moment. All of that, in its own way, is in this moment. Enjoy this moment. There isn't any goal to existence. It's all now. Existence doesn't have that kind of purpose. It's not a business. Got to have so much, by the end of the month so I can meet all my bills. No. You never got a bill from God in your life, did you? No. Simply the joy of existing, of being. We're not going anywhere. We're here. And it's up to you to enjoy or not to enjoy. You know, they say freedom in this way is always your choice. There isn't any way to escape from here. The world isn't moving closer to some goal that, you know, once the world achieves the goal, then the world's going to be finished. You think the world has got a big goal it's moving toward, and when it reaches there, it's going to be finished? I mean, in your fantasies, you know, you reach this goal, but what happens after that? It's like the Hollywood movie, you know. The movie ends, but you don't, you know. And if the world ended like that, if it achieved its goal and ended, what are you going to do? Have you ever thought about it? If there were a goal for the world, and the world achieved this goal, what will become of you? If the whole existence achieves a goal, there wouldn't be anywhere to go. There's nowhere to move. Everything would stop. It achieved its goal, and we would just be dangling there someplace, huh? Because we hadn't achieved yet. What are we going to do? It isn't that way at all. Life is just simply an ongoing affair. You know, as I said, it's not a movie that comes to an end, happy or otherwise. It's not a novel that you can put down anytime you want. We don't know of any beginning. And we don't know of any ending. We are always in the middle. Oh, just know that. We are always in the middle. And that's the way things are. We accept it. Blessed be the day that I am really in the middle. Then I'm balanced. I'm in the middle. But you know, some people, you know, they choose some strange things for goals. You know, they have lots of self-torture, flagellation, and they punish themselves with guilt. Oh, we can go all around the world and say, oh, look at that great man, for 3 months he hasn't eaten. You know, look at our guru. For years he has not slept. Or he is sleeping on a bed of thorns. And people have called this great, huh? He has lived a life of celibacy. He's never enjoyed any relationship with anybody. And so has denied himself all the beauty that love can give. And this is the goal? Well, in India, there's a man who's been standing for 10 years. And a visitor going by, you know, said, okay, he's standing there, but what has he done? Oh, he's standing there. Isn't that great? Standing for 10 years. And the visitor looked at him and, you know, he's standing and his feet and his legs, thick, you know. All the blood, you know, after 10 years had gone down to his legs. He had become legs. The rest of his body had shrunk. Big elephant legs, though. He couldn't sit down if he wanted to now. The flexibility of the body was gone. And his eyes, they were very dull and rather idiotic. But he was enjoying his way. Lots of people came to see him. His goal, huh? Money was being poured at his feet, and all these flowers. And there was even some respect for this long, slow suicide called asceticism. Maybe that's why I like Zen. I don't want to bother with all that stuff. I can't imagine standing 10 years or going to bed on a row of thorns or nails or whatever, you know. How awful, huh? Yeah. But there's lots of it. You know, even in this country, at Easter time, there is a parade in New Mexico where the Christians go up the mountain and they are chained together, this procession. One by one by one they go up, and everyone beating the one ahead of him. You know, got a short whip, and everybody's whipping everybody else up the mountain to the cross. I don't know. So it's not so far away when we say Eastern countries. It's going on in this country also. Anyway, there was once upon a time a Japanese scholar, and he wanted to understand more about Zen. So he went to a monastery to submit himself to this Roshi to receive koan, these very puzzling riddles to observe, huh? And he was asked, you know, what is mu, this famous koan? Joshu and a monk were walking down the street, and they had been talking about the Buddha nature, and the Roshi had said, well, it is everywhere. And so a little puppy dog runs by, and the little monk picks up the puppy dog and says, does this puppy dog have the Buddha nature? And Joshu says, mu. So now here comes this, it's become a very famous koan. It doesn't have any meaning in Japanese. Chinese, maybe we could say it means nothing or no, as opposite to ku, which means yes. You know, so mu, mu. It's like ho in the Sufis. So Sufis use ho. And Rinzai, you know, he used his quats. People would get to a certain place with him, and he would go, quats! Yeah. Anyway, so this Roshi asked this, said to this little scholar, you know, what is mu? And as a good scholar, he proceeded to look up the syllable in the Japanese and all the other Oriental dictionaries and the encyclopedias to determine, you know, what was the root meaning and what was the habitual usage of this term, mu. The master had said, you meditate on mu, and meditate on something really nonsensical so you can get out of your mind. The mind, the thinking mind, it can manage the sensible. It can manage the reasonable. And it can manage the rational. And it can manage the logical. But it cannot manage the eternal reason, the nonsensical. No. For that, you have to drop the thinking, all the planning and all the conversation, you know, and all your explanations. You got to drop it all. Going back to the source orientation now. If you meditate on mu, what happens? Well, you know in 2 seconds what happens. It doesn't mean anything. If I say to you, meditate on dog, oh, yeah, sure. I can picture a dog. We are human beings. We are capable of picturing something that isn't present. It's phenomenal. It took us a long, 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 long time, hundreds of thousands of years to get to that place. To be able to picture something that wasn't present. Okay, but then dog. Okay, then I don't have a dog right now, but I had a dog when I was a kid. Or if I didn't have a dog when I was a child, well, somebody down the street has a dog. Anyway, you know dog, huh? And then you begin to think of the dogs that you've been afraid of and the dogs that you have liked, or maybe the dog that your girlfriend had or your boyfriend had, whatever the case may be. And boy, we are off and running, huh? This is this law of association. It's law of association is going around the mulberry bush. Right. But this term move, what are you going to do with that? Where are you going to go with that? You can't go around the barn with it. You're just stuck. This is moo. Doesn't remind you of anything, and it doesn't make any sense. There's nothing you can associate with it, this moo. So comes this frustration, and pretty soon comes boredom. Bored with myself. Because I can't think and I can't plan and I can't do this and I can't do that. All I've got is this moo, 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 moo. Finally, the mind says, you drop this, that's enough, you know. I can't think about it anymore. What's to think about? You know, it doesn't lead anywhere, goes nowhere. And finally, if you really stick with it, with this concentration on just moo, when the mind feels so fed up with the whole thing, that all of a sudden, of itself, it just drops. It just disappears. And in that moment, then, there is this glimpse of reality. It is not difficult. It is not easy. Read. Huh? Anyway, this scholar presented his findings out of the dictionary to this teacher, who heard what he had to say, ready reading out of what's in the dictionary, and out. You know, he waved him away. So then this scholar began to think, well, maybe this question is more subtle than I realized, what is moo. And he tried then to analyze the tonal component of the syllable. And he did it in every language of the Chinese group, Mandarin, Cantonese, and all. And again, he presented his findings and his research to this teacher, who looked at him. And you know, they sometimes have very big eyes. And his teacher now decided it was time to convince this poor scholar of the seriousness of the situation. It's not a question of another academic thinking excursion. So he said to him, I will give you one more chance. If you do not solve this riddle, I will cut off your legs. And this poor little scholar couldn't believe what he heard. You know, at most, you can fail, but off with the legs, you know. And the threat frightened him out of his wits, so to speak. And if you've ever faced one of these people with a threat like that, you are frightened out of your wits. So finally, he comes now to this. He completely concentrated on the syllable itself. And in the process of this concentration, he achieved the result. A non-verbal result. Now, people who are not accustomed to, or should I say not privy to, this extreme concentration, you know, brought about by in a koan, one of these riddles or one of these problems or exercises, they don't realize, you know, that each of them in a way is a matter of life and death. Have you ever thought the really important questions, the really compelling questions, that faced you. You cannot look for an answer in a dictionary. You can't look for an answer in an encyclopedia. The answer comes out of you. There is no place where the meaning of your life is written up. No newspaper, no book. No book, no scripture has the answer for your life. Got a lot of hopeful things in it which you could do with your life, but it is not the answer to your life. And there is no one who can give you an answer to your life. It has to come out of you. It is your life. It is life limited by you. But there is understanding. The real path, you know, Lao Tzu called it Dao, called it a way. He didn't say there is a God, he said there's a way. There isn't a goal, there's a way. The real path, the way, is not of finding the answer, but of finding true understanding. Understanding truth. Understanding yourself in truth. Understanding life in truth. Understanding, you know, Solomon said it, with all you're getting, get understanding. In the light of understanding, this glimpse of reality, or glimpses of reality, or this total seeing of reality, see, in the light of that understanding, the question just disappears. See? And suddenly, you are the answer. You are the answer to it all. Okay. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much for coming.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.